Hello and welcome to Anesthesia on Air. My name's Owen Dorr. I'm the RCOA podcast fellow, and we've got a slightly different episode for you today. We want to introduce you to a podcast that we think you'll be really interested in, hosted by our friends at TopMed Talks. This one today is about the challenges of AI in healthcare, which is a conversation with a researcher and anaesthetist, Dr. Joe Alderman. We hope you enjoy.
TopMed Talk.
This is TopMed Talk, the broadcasting arm of EBPOM, evidence-based perioperative medicine. The EBPOM World Congress is taking place this year between the 7th and the 9th of July at the British Library in London. Check out ebpom.org now.
Hello, welcome to TopMed Talk. It's a real pleasure to be joined this afternoon by Dr. Joseph Alderman. So Joe and I met at a meeting in Birmingham before Christmas, but it's a real pleasure to have Joe joining us today to talk about why AI fails to reach patients. So Joe, I'll hand over to you. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, thanks, Andrew. And it's a great pleasure to be with you today. So as Andrew said, my name is Joe. I'm an NIHR academic clinical lecturer at the University of Birmingham. So I spend half my time in the NHS. I'm an anaesthetist and intensive care doctor. I spend the other half of my time working at the University of Birmingham as a postdoctoral researcher in AI and digital healthcare. I'll tell you a bit about my story just to give a bit of context. I graduated in medicine back in 2015, and I started my career as a junior researcher in the years that followed. I actually used to be working in cell biology. I was particularly interested in a field called immunometabolism. So how our immune system interacts with our metabolic system to make us critically ill, what kind of influences those processes. There's obviously a lot of data that is in that kind of work. And I pivoted my research back in the early 2020s into AI and digital healthcare. And most of my work at the moment, I'm focused mostly on the governance, regulation, and policy around AI and healthcare. So how do we build the processes that ensure that these novel, exciting technologies actually do get into practice, benefit our patients? But also, how do we build systems that protect patients and the wider public and society from the harm that these technologies could introduce if we do that badly? So that's kind of who I am and what I do.
Fantastic. First of all, Joe, before we get into the AI question specifically, can you tell us a bit more about what made you make that switch, perhaps?
Well, I'd love to say it's some sort of clear, kind of rational decision, but actually it was more of a kind of a stars aligning opportunistic moment, really. I saw a PhD advertised with the current team I work with, and it was really well aligned to the area of research I wanted to move into. So I jumped with both feet, and that's how I met my current supervisor and mentor, and Professor Alistair Denniston, and colleague Dr. Xiao Lu, who now works at Microsoft AI. And then I joined the team and haven't looked back since.
Brilliant. What a great opportunity. So go on, let's dive in. So why don't so many AI initiatives, projects reach it into the patient space?
Look, it's a really good question. And I'll caveat that I don't think there's a right answer to this question. And in fact, I'm not going to give it today. I'm going to give you my opinions and my perspectives. But I think there were three main things that came to mind when I was kind of asked to talk on this topic. And those three things are misalignment, inadequate resourcing, and maybe we could dive into each of those for the rest of our conversation.
Yeah, that sounds perfect. So over to you then. Which of those do you want to tackle first?
Well, let's kick off with misalignment, because I think that's probably the most straightforward one to grasp. So in essence, I guess this would be the seemingly great AI idea isn't actually that great after all. So we have presumed that the idea is great, but actually it doesn't really do the thing we want it to. I think it's often the case that developers might be focusing their time, energy, and resource just simply on the wrong problems. So we're not involving patients and the wider public. We're not involving clinicians and health workers and even people in management leadership positions in health service or in hospitals in making decisions about where we put our resources. And what that means is that we produce technologies, we produce systems that do really interesting, cool things, but actually don't solve pain points, real world issues that we need solving on behalf of the NHS and on behalf of patients. I think this kind of links through to optimization against basically the wrong targets. There's this phenomenon of, I think it's Goodhart's law, that when we start to use a measurement as a target, it stops being a good measurement. And healthcare is littered with this sort of thing, where we try and over-optimize for certain things. But actually, when we peel back the layers, we realize that the thing we're optimizing against isn't necessarily the right thing. So one example from healthcare, not really an AI example, but just a general healthcare example, is in the UK, emergency departments are measured according to a set of metrics, including how long patients wait before they've been seen and how long patients wait to be admitted to hospital. And there's this really live one at the moment, the 4-hour wait. So patients shouldn't wait more than 4 hours. And obviously, that's a good thing. We don't want patients waiting long times. The problem is that if we try and optimize against that 4-hour wait, we might end up with slightly strange behaviors. We might end up with a rush to admit patients to the hospital, but then a very long delay before they get their treatment. Now, from the patient's perspective, they don't want to be admitted to hospital quickly. They want to get their treatment fast. And so the metric is being kind of almost gamed to make it look like the system's performing better. And when we have this kind of misalignment where we don't really understand the system we're developing for, there's a real risk that we fix the metric, but we haven't really fixed the underlying system. And I think that's a really common problem that I see for really cool technologies that are out there that just fundamentally are just off target in terms of what we actually need in the real world practice.
It's a really interesting point. And I think, I guess the analogy from a more, I'm going to call it a classical research point of view, but I don't necessarily mean classical in that sense, but a non-AI point of view, but any other big research project that we do, quite rightly, the patient is sort of first, foremost and center in driving that through, isn't it? In terms of the question, the patient involvement through the project, through a clinical trial, there's normally a lay representative on a trial management board. The trials normally have a lay summary. All the sort of recruitment material is written in lay language.
Yeah,
that's just not there in the same way yet in the AI space.
I think that's probably fair, or certainly not as good as it could be. I mean, there are examples out there where this is done really well, but I think it's far more common that products and AI health technologies are developed without having substantial or sufficient patient involvement. And I mean, you mentioned research. Research is a good example. So over the last kind of 20, 30 years, we've, I think, pivoted largely from patients being excluded from decisions around research to now patient involvement and engagement being, well, you can't get a research grant in the UK unless you have substantial patient and public involvement on any grant application, for instance. There is the James Lind Alliance Priority Setting Partnerships, where members of the public are brought on board to actually say, well, what are the top 10 things you want solving in this area? You know, in the area of oncology, what are the top 10 areas of research? What are the top 10 things that you really want researchers and scientists to fix in order to say we've done a good thing for the specialty area? And I think the reality is that because AI systems are created in often the open market by companies rather than by researchers, that control of having to have patient involvement on grants doesn't necessarily feed through to technologies being developed with patients in mind.
And maybe that's one of the things that leads to this misalignment you talk about, that if it's company-driven, it's company-target-driven, it's four-hour wait target-driven, rather than what the healthcare needs
of the system really are, perhaps?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I don't think this isn't me pointing the finger at companies saying that they're deliberately doing the wrong thing. I think it's just very hard to know what the real issues are unless you live them every day. So patients and the public are the ones with personal lived experience of actually experiencing a health condition. You know, if you're someone living with diabetes, you know what that's like. And someone who doesn't have diabetes just doesn't. You know, that's just the reality of what it is. If you're someone who works there every day in the health system, you know full well what it's like to operate in a resource constrained, time limited, high pressure environment where you don't have enough time or resource to do your job effectively. If you don't actually live that world, it's very hard to build systems and technologies which try and improve those lives. Now, that's not to say it can't be done. It just means that you need to embed that expertise, the public expertise or the professional expertise, in your design process in some way. And doing that meaningfully in a way which is respectful of people's time and expertise, which is not exploitative. So people are paid or compensated in some way for their time and energy and their commitment, where their input actually has a meaningful, tangible difference to the work you do. That's really hard to get right. And whilst I said there are good examples out there, there are lots more examples where it hasn't gone quite right. And I mentioned briefly on professionals. I mean, we've touched a lot on patients and the public, but when we're solving for health problems in terms of health sector problems, obviously clinicians and people who work on the front lines are really important stakeholders. It's just too often that we see technologies built for the health system rather than kind of with the health system. And I think that's a trend I'd like to see undone in 2026 and onwards, really.
That was going to be my next point, actually. But often it's not just the patients who are the end users of these AI technologies, are there? I mean, and like you say, clinician engagement, clinician input is vital for so many. And, you know, some AI tools do have very good clinician engagement, but not all of them, in my experience. I agree. I think that's something that we absolutely can work on going forwards. Go on then. What's your second point again? Remind us of point in three.
So the second point, I guess, would be inadequate resourcing. So again, thinking through to why good ideas don't get into practice. Building AI health technologies, it's really hard and it's costly. To operate in such a tightly regulated sector, you need to prove that your thing works, that it meets any claims that you make, but also that it's safe for patients and for the wider system in order to get access to market. Getting that product from an idea on paper through to actually something that's treating patients is a long and time-consuming and costly process. And that's before we even consider that many AI technologies will obviously be critically dependent on data, not just development data, but also access to information. You know, the stack of getting information from a live clinical record through a computer system, maybe based in the cloud, maybe based on physical hardware, and then into kind of outputs that then influence patients. I mean, that's a very complex and costly process. And I think, simply put, the resources we have in terms of pump priming research grants to get cool new ideas up and running, investment capital to actually scale concepts and build products into larger companies and have all of the quality assurance, quality and risk management that you need in order to operate safely. And then the infrastructure to actually deliver that project and that product at scale over time sustainably. It's very challenging. The timescales to get that money and that funding are often too long. The availability of funding is often too small, meaning that, you know, good ideas just can't get off the ground. There are millions of folks worldwide at the moment who use direct-to-consumer large language models to manage their own healthcare. In fact, a report from OpenAI a few weeks back showed that 5% of queries going through ChatGPT are healthcare related in some way. So that's millions of queries, probably billions of queries a day related to healthcare. And this is obviously a great opportunity for public empowerment, but also poses a real risk to the public because we know that large language models can hallucinate and maybe overly agreeable and can give out inaccurate guidance. So me and my team were able to identify this urgent need. And because we had a small amount of flexible funding available, we were able to get moving with the project really quickly. We built an international collaboration and we've moved with that research very fast. And we're about to launch our initiative to build a health chatbot user guide. But the reality is, when ideas like this come around, in most cases, teams just don't have the resourcing, the time or the expertise locally to get going with them. And the opportunity moves past too quickly. So I think some really great ideas simply wither on the vine because we don't have access to tools and to money and resourcing to let teams and experts actually build those out. So one thing I'd love to see improve as we move forward is greater flexibility for researchers to actually get going with stuff, taking more risks, accepting that the majority of projects won't go anywhere. But it's really important to try and see and learn, to fail and fail quickly and to learn from failure so that actually the next thing comes about more reliably.
I love that. We'll come back to your AI chatbot in a second. That's another amazing bit of innovation we should definitely talk about. But I think you're right. The resource issue is probably underestimated. I think people often think AI is such a big and up-and-coming thing nowadays that there's almost just resource falling off to try and make it happen. I think alongside that, the regulation side you mentioned is also pretty key to that. And I mean, healthcare is such a tightly regulated industry through and through. I'm going to play devil's advocate with you a little bit, though. I mean, is AI as well regulated as the rest of the healthcare industry?
I'm going to caveat by saying that I'm not a regulatory expert, but I do have some engagement with the regulatory side. I think it's fair to say that regulation could be better. And in fact, that brings me on to a point I'll make a bit later on, but now's a good time as well, that the Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency, the UK's medicines and, well, healthcare products regulator, the MHRA, currently has an AI commission, which is running until next May. And that's chaired by Professor Alistair Denniston and deputy chaired by Professor Henrietta Hughes. And as part of this commission, there is a call for evidence open right now. So depending on when this episode goes out, there might be an opportunity to contribute to that. So that's a close on the 2nd of February. And the whole purpose of this commission is to think through, well, how could we do better here? What would a ideal regulatory framework for AI in healthcare in the UK look like? What are the current bits that are working? What are the current bits that aren't working? And how can we smooth the barriers to entry to the market, but also ensure rigorous and safety and that sort of thing. So definitely improvements that are possible. I accept the point that regulation could always be better, but hopefully we're starting to see some signals that things are moving in a good direction.
I think that's perfect and really exciting. Regulation can be a burden as well as a blessing. And, you know, we've covered on other episodes of Top Med Talk, people trying to get systems up and going where, you know, the data governance has just been such a hurdle to overcome. And you mentioned about data on the cloud, data is protected to very strict levels in the UK and internationally. That can be a real challenge to
get some of these things up and started as well. Particularly when you talked about resource limitation in point one, often there's a significant investment required early on to get those systems in place, that infrastructure in place to handle that data before you've even generated any data to go into those boxes.
Yeah, well, I mean, data privacy, data protection is obviously a very important topic. It's come to salience in recent years with very high profile cybersecurity issues, major corporations leaking information, being hacked, and consumer data being lost. We don't want that happening in healthcare. I think a very clear example of why these rules exist, because it would be devastating if a large health organization were to have the same sort of data privacy breach that high profile companies have had. The opportunity cost of that is that puts a big barrier to entry. And I think getting that balance right between protecting individual data subjects, people, and enabling technologies to be developed, that is a tough one. And I think one point I'll make on this is that, you know, we as ivory tower experts working in universities are not probably the right people to make these rules. It's really important that conversations around this sort of trade-off are had in the open forum of a functioning democracy. So I think it's really important that the public are part of this conversation, that we listen to them and engage with them properly, but also to play out that full trade-off that we can't necessarily achieve perfect privacy, because perfect privacy comes at a cost. We equally probably don't want to have all your information flowing all over the place, because that doesn't seem very good either. But is there a sensible middle ground or even an improvement on what we're doing right now, which maximizes data protection as best possible, but also enables a little bit more data sharing so that we can actually develop these technologies more smoothly?
And what's your third, the sort of tripartite of these three before we dive into more detail?
So the third one, solutioneering, is one I borrowed. But this is effectively where we jump too quickly into the development and building rather than spending the time and energy to actually properly understand the problem we're trying to fix for. There are so many ways that we can go wrong here if we move too fast. The least harmful of those are just overrunning in terms of timescales and budgets. There are much worse things that can go wrong when we jump too quickly to building. And history outside of healthcare, probably in healthcare too, is littered with examples of massive projects gone wrong because of a simple failure to actually just understand the problem, to plan, and a bias towards early action. This idea that let's just get going and run with it and see where we get to, without properly doing the work beforehand to think through it. And I think one common way this manifests in healthcare and probably pertinent to our discussion today is an assumption that AI is the solution. Because in many cases, it might well be that a more straightforward data science approach, maybe even just a simple tweak to the system, might actually be much better, might be far cheaper, and might be better scalable to the wider health system. We know that when we develop AI systems, that comes with huge costs. We talked about regulatory burdens, data access requirements. If we can do something faster, simpler, more straightforward, which costs less money and achieves the same outcome or even a better outcome, that seems to me to be a sensible way to start.
So this probably feeds back to what Alistair talked about in his talk as the imagination, extrapolation and desperation of AI, I guess, that we're obviously so desperate for AI to be the next big thing. It's the key talk about topic, but maybe we jump to it too many times, or we, as you say, we miss the easy option and go for something more complicated, perhaps.
I think that's completely right. And look, this isn't an AI unique thing. Throughout history, there's been a tendency towards wanting to do the next cool thing because it gets headlines. And I think we have to forgive ourselves from having that tendency, because inevitably we get excited about stuff, and being excited is great. But I think we need to also temper that enthusiasm and think through the problem properly and recognize when the right thing to do is to do nothing, or the right thing to do is to do the quick thing, because the quick thing is deliverable now and will make a real difference. One comment that we sometimes have is that, you know, the health service in the UK is in crisis. There are lots of people waiting on waiting lists. Access to healthcare is worsening. Health inequalities are widening. We need to do something urgently and big to fix this decline. And therefore, we need AI. I'd argue that's a bit of a non sequitur, because the assumption is that AI will fix that problem. But we've already talked about how the fact that AI might not work, it might be costly, it might be time consuming. There might be something we can put in faster, which makes a small difference to a large number of people while we're building the perfect AI system, because the perfect AI system might take longer to develop than we have to develop it ready.
I think coming back to the point you made very eloquently earlier, that perfect AI system eventually might fix everything, but also it really needs to be developed and tested and, I guess, regulated in that environment, which itself takes time, right? I mean, we can't test it out in a model system and then drop it into a complex NHS environment and expect it's just going to pick up and work as soon as we set it off. And I guess so often that seems to be the sort of approach that happens with an AI model. We start straight in on the big scale and then have to try and fix some of the bits as we go along, perhaps.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point as well. Look, gone are the days of having to spend years and years and years doing trials. I mean, that's definitely the case that we'll have to work towards in rare diseases, for instance. If we're working in pharmaceutical research, you know, we might simply not have very many patients with a certain condition. It just takes a long time to get a trial up and running and recruited. But I think AI is a bit different. Data-driven technologies are a bit different. There are opportunities to generate evidence as to whether something works through silent mode evaluations where you run the system in the background and retrospective analyses where you run it on information you already have, or in silico studies where you simulate an environment and see how it performs. So definitely ways to accelerate that information gathering process, but you are right that generating robust evidence that a thing works, and crucially, robust evidence to highlight where it doesn't work and where the harms might be, that's really challenging. Because it's very easy to show something works, but hopefully we're all mature enough to know that systems will fail in some way. And if you don't know how a system fails, it doesn't mean it doesn't fail. It just means you don't know how it fails. So I would far rather have a system where I understand its failures and I know that there are quite a lot of them than something which looks perfect, because perfection is probably not achievable. And it just means you don't have the information you need yet.
I'm desperate to ask about more about your AI bot then. So explain more about how that's been developed and how it works and what it's going to see.
Well, I mean, look, this is very early days, but basically recognizing that there are lots of people already using direct consumer chatbots, you know, ChatGPT, Google Gemini, Claude, or Copilot, those tools which are not healthcare specific, they're actually general purpose technologies, but they're using them for healthcare purposes because they have access to those tools and they have problems that they need help with, or because they find it an easier way to ask questions than booking a general practitioner appointment or whatever. This has great opportunity, but also great risk. So our team basically wants to provide the public with a set of guidance, which will help them to avoid the very worst harms, and also possibly to know how they could use these tools in a particularly beneficial way to improve their healthcare. We start from a kind of position of pragmatic neutrality. We're not saying that this is a good thing to do. We're not saying that the public should or should not use these tools for this purpose. We're just recognizing that it's already happening, and it can either happen with guidance or it can happen without guidance. And asking patients to navigate this complex information space without any guidance is probably a bit unreasonable. And it's incumbent on us, as I think experts and professionals, to take the knowledge which exists out there, the very technical information discussed in AI safety research at the cutting edge, where researchers are discussing things like prompt injections, where a language model can be manipulated to give an incorrect answer through external information, and translate that for the general public to explain what that risk is and how they can avoid it. Because if the public doesn't know what the problems are, then they're inclined probably to think that these systems are less risky than they actually might be. I'd far rather we had a long list of potential problems so people could be aware and informed than to just assume that they don't exist, recognizing there'll be benefits and costs of any technology and that information is power in this kind of world.
Absolutely. And can you maybe illustrate using that system as an example of how you and your team have overcome those sort of three main challenges, or at least if not overcome, manage those three main challenges that we talked about to kind of get that tool up and running to the point that it now is?
Yeah, well, I think the first thing it'd say is that this project has only just started, so we haven't yet got anything in terms of an offer. I think we were in a good space because we were able to avoid the misalignment issue, because we actually, I think, have formed a team which actually understands the problem. We didn't just focus on AI experts. We brought into the conversation public and patient representatives right from the very start. We've got people who work in policy, regulation, psychology, ethics, clinicians like myself, to actually understand the problem from different angles. I mentioned already the resourcing issue. This kind of project needs a small grant to get started normally, and small grants can be surprisingly complicated and competitive. If you need £20,000 to get a project off the ground, that can be really hard to find, surprisingly harder than finding £10 million maybe for in VC money. So that initial phase was a lot faster for us because we were able to find that money through other means. But you know, that was just good fortune, really, rather than good planning. And then lastly, solutioneering. So we're adamant that we don't have an endpoint in mind with this project. We're mapping out what the overall aim for this is, you know, what we want to achieve in the world, which is patient empowerment, risk mitigation, risk management, risk reduction, and better communication discourse around large language models for healthcare. But we're actually spending quite a long time on working out how we get to that endpoint without being biased towards a particular product or a particular method. Because we recognize that if we just start going too fast, then we might end up heading off wrong, on the wrong course and making a thing which doesn't achieve what we want it to. So I guess that's an embodiment of all the three things we talked about, really.
Well, brilliant piece of work. Really well done. And thank you very much for coming to explain those three points so eloquently and so clearly as well. And you've clearly got a lot of experience in this area yourself. What about people that, and they've got less experience in the AI space? How can clinicians or patients or people get more involved and learn more about this?
Yeah, it's such an important question. And I think one of the big challenges we have, particularly as we move forward into this new world of developing AI and digital technologies for healthcare, is that we have a widening skills gap. So we have experts who understand how health systems work. We have experts who understand how machine learning and AI works and data works, and a big gap between those two people. And it may be even a third area of expertise, which is policy regulation, oversight, governance, that sort of thing. And very few people who can translate between those different silos, really. So I think it's really important that we start to build out that center ground, people who can actually do that work to translate between different groups of experts. And that can be a really challenging place to be, because if you have feet in multiple groups, then maybe you feel like you're not spending enough time with any one of them. But this kind of role is going to be increasingly important as we move forward. And so two main opportunities, maybe three opportunities, I'll just flag for listeners who might be interested in building towards a role where they can communicate between those two different experts or three different expert groups. For those in the UK, there's the NHS Fellowship in Clinical AI, which is a 12-month program which runs alongside a clinical training program. And it enables professionals, not just doctors, but healthcare professionals generally, to run a innovation project alongside their training and to basically build themselves and to be one of the AI leaders of the future. So that's definitely something to check out. You can Google just NHS Clinical AI Fellowship. I'll also flag that the University of Birmingham, where I work, is a bit of a self-flag. We have a new, as in new year just gone, Master of Science, MSc program in healthcare AI implementation. So that's addressing a similar gap, but maybe with a more formal education offer rather than a fellowship alongside training. And the last thing just to flag for those who are maybe international and can't access those other two resources, there are an increasing number of communities of practice worldwide, particularly many of them in the UK as well. So there's the NIHR Incubator for AI and Digital Healthcare. There's the NHS AI Ambassadors Network. And then there's the Alan Turing Institute's Clinical AI Interest Group and many other groups beside. And these normally offer a once a month or once a week online meeting. So relatively low cost, where you can just join a meeting, you can learn a little bit more about the world of medical AI, you can maybe make some connections and start your journey towards that new role. So just some things to flag as opportunities for the listeners there.
We'll try and make sure we can put some links to some of those in the show notes when this is released. So again, thank you very much for coming to join us, Joe. Really well explained, amazing, isn't it, eloquently explained points. I've learned a lot. Hopefully we'll get you back on the podcast in the future to hear about your works going.
Thanks, Andrew.
As always, thank you very much for listening to Top Med Talk. You can hear this episode and all our others on our website through your podcaster of choice and through our social media sites. We're on them all: YouTube, LinkedIn, Facebook, Blue Sky. If you do find us through one of those, please do hit like, hit subscribe. It makes a real difference to us at this end. It keeps us free at the point of access for you listening at home. And of course, we need to thank our fantastic sponsors, who this year are BD and GE. Thanks, George, for listening.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
As always, you can hear this episode and all other episodes through our website, through your social media selection of choice, whether that's Blue Sky, LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram. We're on them all, but please do hit like, hit subscribe. It makes a really big difference to us at this end. And you'll find a new podcaster of choice. And finally, as always, we need to thank our sponsors who keep us free at the point of access. And this year, that is BD and GE. Thank you very much.
Top Med Talk.
TopMed Talk is the broadcasting arm of EdPOM, evidence-based perioperative medicine. Join clinicians from around the world at EdPOM World Congress 2026 between the 7th and the 9th of July at the British Library in London. 3 days of evidence-based perioperative medicine, global insights and expert debate, featuring speakers including Michael Marmot and Ken Rockwood. Go now to edpom.org. That's edpom.org.
Thanks for listening. I hope you found that useful and enjoyed it like I did. If you did like this type of content, please do look at the episode description and have a look at the array of fantastic talks that the TopMed team have created. Otherwise, please do subscribe to Anesthesia on Air for more fantastic podcasts from us.